Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, everyone. Michael Anthony here. Van Halen, Chickenfoot, Sammy in the Circle. But anyway, you're listening to the only podcast that is dedicated to breaking down the entire Van Halen catalog one track at a time. And the podcast will rock. Ow!
Hello, baby!
What is up, all you rockers, rockettes, and everything in between? Thank you for joining us for a new edition of And the Podcast Will Rock. Welcome back to the show, everybody. If you're new to the show, you just stumbled upon us. Well, welcome. Thank you. And let me tell you about what we do. We are the show that dives into the catalog and discography of one of the greatest rock and roll bands of all time, Van Halen. And we do it one track at a time. And we're nearing the end, ladies and gents. I don't even want to think about it. So we're not going to think about that. Instead, we're just going to have just a kick-ass, fun, special, unique show. But I can't do it by myself. I, your co-host, Mark Kamire, with me, as always, Corey Morissette. Corey, how are you feeling tonight?
You know, I'm feeling all right. I was going through Podcast Will Rock withdrawals over the weekend because we released shows the last couple of weeks, but they're from the live show, just kind of into two different episodes. So you and I actually haven't got together and recorded a show in a few weeks here, so I kind of missed you, Mark. What have you been up to?
Oh, I miss you too, man. But sometimes it's good that we have these live shows to where we can actually kind of, you know, take a breather a week, and we needed a breather. I myself was busy these past couple of weeks for a couple of gigs, singing some familiar tunes from the 80s, and for both shows actually. So I can, for all of you that were in the know, I can tell you, based on everything I heard that night, Painkiller went off in spades. So we did. It was all good. I did not crack. I did the thing. I think in my heart of hearts, I think I made Rob Halford very proud. So thank you to all the encouraging words to all of you out there and your support. I needed it. I've never stressed out about doing a performance so hard in my life, but I'm glad it went over. And then by that point, when I did Dream Warriors by Dokken, it was a piece of cake. So, you know, if you can get through Painkiller, you can get through anything. So that and pet sitting a we're sort of fostering a third cat, and he's sort of throwing a wrench into everything because our cats do not like him, and it's been a pain in the ass, and we're trying to maintain sanity here. So that's what's been going on with me. How about you?
I tell you what, I've been busy working this month producing live telethons. The only thing that's gotten me through, actually, sitting in my hotel room during the brief breaks I had producing this telethon, was a book that I was reading, and a book that we were going to talk about tonight. And we are very, very fortunate to have the author of that book on the show. Mark, why don't you let the folks know who we got joining us here tonight?
That's right. What a book indeed. From the author that brought you Tone Chaser, Understanding Edward, My 26-Year Journey with Edward Van Halen. Please welcome to the show, Steve Rosen. Steve, guys. Hello. Welcome.
Hello. Hello, guys. How are you doing?
We're doing great. Good, man. And it's a real pleasure to have you here. Maybe tell us where folks can find your book.
Absolutely. So you can find it on my website. Very simple. Tonechaserbook.com. One word. You can also find it on Amazon, eBay, Reverb, and Etsy. And please, after you've read the book, go back to Amazon and leave a review for me, okay? That would be fantastic.
What a fantastic book. Like, automatically off the bat, if you're expecting, like, I know it was originally, and I want you to get you to talk about that right off the hop. It was originally going to be the official autobiography of Edward Van Halen. It turned into something much more, in that you're not talking about his technique ad nauseum or the albums or the tours. You're just talking about your friend, which really makes this such an interesting account. Maybe tell us a little bit about yourself and about how you got to meet Eddie Van Halen.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's 1977, June of 1977. I had been writing for about 4 years at that point. I was writing regularly for Guitar Player. So I had done a bunch of, you know, big stories for them. By the time I met Edward, there was a Jeff Beck cover, there was a John McLaughlin cover. There was a John Entwistle cover. So before I met Edward, I'd done, you know, a lot of, I think I describe it in the book as heavy literary lifting. I had met a lot of very cool, amazing guitar players. So it's a Friday night, June 77. I'm at the Whiskey with my brother. We're there to see Cheap Trick record a live record. And Michelle Meyer, who is the girl who booked the Whiskey and someone I had been friends with. I had played in a band and she kindly had booked me into some of these other clubs that she was booking. And so I owed her and you know, I love Michelle. And on top of that, she was, and I describe her in the very kindest way as a yenta. She knew everything that was worth knowing, you know, that was going on musically. She knew I was a big guitar guy. I was writing for guitar mags. So I'm there at the Whiskey. I'm downstairs waiting for Cheap Trick to come on. She says, come upstairs. There's somebody you have to meet. So I walk upstairs into one of these, you know, pit of hell, you know, whiskey dressing rooms, you know, cigarette smoke and there's trash all around, you know. I mean, it's old rock and roll, room. Right? And yeah. I see this guy standing in the corner. Now, you have to understand, this is 1977. There haven't been any interviews written about Edward, no stories or no, you know, photograph arrays, right? There's no internet, you know, there's no million pictures of Edward Van Halen. I'm pretty sure I had seen flyers of Van Halen, and I'm pretty sure I recognized him, but it's possible I didn't. The thing is, I had never seen Van Halen play live. So I'm just meeting this guy. This Edward Van Halen. I knew that they had scored a deal on Warner Brothers, which blew me away. I thought, well, my God, they have to be an amazing band to get a deal on Warner Brothers. So Michelle walks me and my brother over and, you know, we shake hands and we start talking and I don't know how it comes up, you know, but Eric Clapton comes up, you know, and I was a monster Clapton fan. I mean, I love Cream and, you know, the male stuff and, you know, going back to the Rooster days and his early, early blues stuff. I mean, I knew a lot about Eric Clapton. And so obviously not knowing it, you know, Clapton was one of Ed's guys. And so we start talking about Clapton and he starts talking about Cream. And there's just this immediate connection, mate. You know, it's like when you meet that person and it feels like you're engaging in a conversation that sort of began a long time ago, and now you're just catching up to it. And that's what it felt like. We started talking about Blackmore, you know, and again, I was a monster Blackmore fan. Jeff Beck came up. I mean, these are all guys that I loved, you know. And I was a bit of a snob. I was a bit of an elitist, I must admit. Because I'd listened so much to Purple and Richie and, you know, Clapton and Cream, and I knew everything that Jeff did, you know, and the, you know, the Rod Stewart records, and going prior to that, you know, the Trident records and all those little pickup bands. He was, I mean, I knew a lot about those guitar players. So if I was talking to somebody and they made a comment about an artist, you know, if they made a comment, you know, if the subject was Eric Clapton, and they said, you know, some comment about, oh, Eric Clapton, you know, double tracks his solos or some thing that I thought was beneath me, I go, dude, you don't know anything about Eric Clapton. I can't talk to you. You know, it's like this elitist thing in me. It's like, you don't know shit. Why are you talking to me? The thing with Edward was, I don't think Ed understood or knew the chronology of those guys, but Ed had this way deeper understanding than I did of these guys as musicians, as guitar players, and talking about, you know, Clapton's vibrato bar, you know, and that staccato neoclassical thing he did, and you know, Edward's finger tremolo and just the tone. I mean, his was like, you know, I had to run as fast as I could to keep up with him. I mean, his insights were amazing. At the end of the conversation, he runs out of the room, you know, and I'm kind of standing there, and he comes back and he's got a pencil or a pen and picks up some scrap of paper off the floor and writes down, you know, this, I'm not sure what he's writing. He hands it to me and I see it's his phone number. He goes, hey man, you know, this, you know, I like talking to you. You know, call me. I hope we meet again. And that's the first time I met Edward Van Halen. And it, you know, it was just an amazing conversation and it felt comfortable. And honestly, I never knew if I would run into him again. Look, I knew he was on Warner's and I was interviewing, you know, all those Warner bands, you know, the Beach Boys and Sabbath and, you know, Captain Beefheart. I mean, all these bands that I loved. I mean, I was interviewing them. So chances were I was probably going to interview him again at some point. But, you know, the friendship part of it, I mean, you know, if I'm not there that night, I mean, who knows? You know, I mean, do things happen for reasons? I mean, I don't know, man. I don't know.
That's pretty remarkable.
I like to believe they do. Yeah,
I do too. I would absolutely. Too. Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, like, look where we're at right now. It's like you wrote the book about it, your relationship with Edward. And it's like, of course, things happen for a reason, because this exists. This right here was the reason why you were at the Whiskey that night.
Well, you know, Mark, I mean, I'm not one of these crystal gazers and that type of thing, you know, and I don't know about destiny. But the thing is, I mean, I could have been there that night and I could have been just, you know, maybe I was just a guitar player in a band, or I was, you know, I don't know, you know, I worked in a bank or I was a mailman or something, you know, but I think it was really the fact that I was a journalist, you know, and I was a writer and I did have an affinity and I understood guitar players. I'm not saying I ever played like any of those guys, but I understood guitar players. I understood that mentality. I was a songwriter. I understood, you know, the process of writing a song and harmony and chord changes and that kind of thing. And I was able to talk to these guitar players on that level. And I think Edward responded to that. So yes, you know, I was there that night. I was a journalist. I was someone he could speak to. So, you know, yes, what comes out of it is his book. And yeah, man, maybe the confluence of the stars, you know, did come together for a reason. I mean, like you said, man, I would like to think so for sure.
Yeah. I mean, like, well, even if it's not, we're just going to pretend that it is, because now we have this wonderful thing. It's funny. Yeah, I was over here laughing because you mentioned the elitism in our younger days, and it's like, oh boy, you're calling me out real loud over here. I think it's like an unwritten rule that if you're young and you're big into like hard rock, and we'll even say heavy metal especially, I think that elitism sort of just like somehow grows within you and just kind of becomes part of you until finally you just eventually you grow up and go, okay, this is stupid. Or maybe you have someone, and I'm not saying like Eddie did this for you, but like maybe someone comes around and go, hey, lighten up. Or it's just like, you know, you can listen to other things too. Like, how do you think we get inspired to do all this stuff? And it's like, yeah. Oh, well, you're right. It's a spectrum, but,
exactly. Or,
but yeah, yeah.
Or,
it's like,
are running into somebody who knows more than you do about Eric Clapton.
Exactly.
Well, I never have. Yes. So fuck it, I'm the guy. No, I'm kidding, but I know what you're saying, you know.
Would you say that you knew more about Clapton than Eddie?
Not really. I mean, you know, I didn't know a tenth of what Edward understood about those guys as players. You know, my mind didn't work like that. But I knew more about pre-Cream than Ed did. That much I know.
Ah, there you go. So, but it's good. Like, it's a humbly admitting when it's just like, yeah, I can admit it now. And it's like, no, he knew more about Clapton, but I knew more about Cream. And it's like, that's a fair compromise, I think. It seems like that's not the first time we've heard stories about Eddie kind of getting, like, for lack of a better phrase, nerding out on guitar stuff, and sort of just like the, as you say, the understanding of the playability. Would you say like he was just like a really huge guitar nerd?
You know, I mean, in some ways he was, and in some ways he wasn't. And I talk about this in the book. So, you know, it's pretty common knowledge, you know, so Van Halen signing a deal and moving into the Whiskey and the Starwood and playing originals, you know, they're playing cover songs from everybody. The aforementioned Cream, they're doing Purple. You know, ZZ Top, Grand Funk, Spirit. They did a James Brown song because they had to do more dance stuff when they were doing the Zaris, which was kind of like a dance club on the Strip. So he was sort of, you know, subconsciously absorbing all these influences, but he never, it's not like we would sit down and he'd go, man, you know, I love Randy California, and I love Paul Kossoff, and I love Robin Trump. We never had those conversations. And in fact, I don't think he even knew about a lot of those guys. He's over at my house. I live about 10 minutes away from Edward up in the Hollywood Hills. He lives in a big house. I live in a very small house. And he's over, and I had a huge record collection. Before I started writing, I had a big, big record collection. After I started writing, you get put on the mailing list for all the labels. So I was receiving every release from all these labels monthly. So I had a huge, huge record collection. So I remember one time Ed was over, and he knew about my collection. And there, it was kind of like down in a bedroom. The bedroom was like a little sunken. It was kind of like a little hobbit cave, you know, really dark, and, you know, fungus growing on the walls. Not really. So we go down there, and he looks at the records. And I start pulling out records because I thought that he might be interested in hearing them. So, you know, I was just pulling stuff out. So I pulled stuff out by, you know, I had like Larry Carlton records, and I had records by Les Paul, Steely Dan, some prog bands, you know, because he was a big prog guy, but more obscure bands, Coliseum, Soft Machine. And I honestly don't believe he'd ever heard of any of those bands. Look, he knew the Steely Dan, the big hits, but I don't think his knowledge went deeper than that. In answer to your question, was Ed a guitar nerd? I don't really think so. I don't think he listened to a lot of music other than in the early days when he had to listen to a, you know, ZZ Top song to learn the song, and then interpret it in the unique way that he would. But we never had discussions, and I wish we did. I wish I had talked to him more about this, you know, about, you know, what other guitar players did he like? I mean, we all know about Richie and, you know, Jeff Beck peripherally. You know, some people say he hated Hendrix. You know, some people say he loved Hendrix. I never asked him about Jimi Hendrix. You know, we know about Clapton. We know about Alan Holdsworth. But I don't really know how well he knew Paul Kossoff. I'm sure he knew all right now, but I don't know if he went deeper into Free's catalog, you know, or Robin Trower, you know, with Procol Harum, or Martin Barr with Jethro Tull. I mean, he probably knew Aqualung and that kind of thing, but I don't know if he knew like the earlier records. You know, it was a discussion I wish I had. So no, I don't think Ed was a guitar nerd in that way. I don't think he was constantly listening to stuff you know, to find new ideas and new things to play. And in fact, I was 99.9% positive he never listened to one of those records I gave him. And I'm talking about like a serious stack. And he also never gave me my albums back. Which made me mad. No,
well, maybe that answers your question. It's like, you don't think he listened to much stuff. It's like, well, he took your record, so he was probably listening to those at least.
Maybe, I just always thought, well, my God, how cool would it be if he heard an early Supertramp record, and it touched something in him, you know, because a record like that would have moved Edward. I mean, he would have heard something in it, you know, and those are the types of records I tried to pull out for him, you know. He had never heard of Les Paul. Years later, I would introduce him to Les Paul. He subsequently learned about Les from Don Landy, the Van Halen's engineer, who knew all about Les. You know, Don was a tech nerd, you know, of the nth degree. I mean, you know, Don was into the recording thing and into tape, and he knew all about Les and multi-tracking and all that stuff. So he was teaching Edward. But yeah, Ed didn't know about that stuff. So yeah, I mean, I wish I could have spoken to him more about influences and other guitar players I thought he should have heard, you know.
Well, maybe he did that intentionally. Maybe he didn't... Or maybe he kind of separated the two. Like he wanted to focus on his own art, his own guitar playing, and figure things out for himself without feeling like somebody else's influence. Like maybe that to him might have felt disingenuous in some way. Mm-hmm. I don't know. These are the questions that I have, and you know, I'll always have, because I'll never get those answers, unfortunately. But that it is interesting though, and I love the idea that he's just like, I don't listen to much stuff, and he just like steals your records, and that's what he's listening to in secret. Go ahead, Corey.
But Steve, you mentioned we were talking about guitar nerds. I wanted to ask you about this picture. To me, that looks that looks like a good and the mustache is amazing. I wanted to ask you about your hair though, man. That your perm game is super strong there, my friend.
Yeah, you know, I never realized I had a perm. I remember driving to the airport, I came to the show. I can't remember who, and they went, oh yeah, you got the Jufro thing going. I go, indeed I do. You know? I also wore these hideous shorts, and why I would wear those, oh my God, you can't see, yeah, you can. You're like jogging shorts. I'm thinking, what is wrong with you, man?
A rock. Everybody wore those.
Yeah, day on the green, you know, and I wore those. I mean, I did have nice legs, guys. I will tell you that. But
there you go. Got to show them.
Yeah,
off.
So
that's right.
The choices we make, you know.
Well, you can't talked see about
it.
Eddie.
My hair's pulled back, but I would have had a perm.
Yeah, Mark's getting pretty close to that. You mentioned other guitar players, Steven, and you tell a great story in the book about introducing Eddie to Ritchie Blackmore. Maybe tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah,
Ritchie Blackmore. So I knew Ritchie was one of Edward's guys. And in fact, the first time I heard Van Halen 1, I was not impressed. I truly didn't think it was a very good record. To me, it just sounded kind of like a different version of Purple. You know, it's fast kind of shuffles and those similar kinds of grooves and, you know, the vibrato bar thing. And, I kind of dismissed it like that. I subsequently sat down the next day and listened to it very carefully and realized, oh my God, this is, you know, the rewriting of the entire architecture of electric guitar. But it did take me a minute to understand that. But I did hear Ritchie and his playing early on. So it's that first or the second Rainbow record. I think is that 79, 80? Rainbow was playing at Long Beach Arena, which is about 40 miles south of where I lived, or where Edward lived in Long Beach. And I had scored tickets and backstage passes. So I thought, how amazing would it be to take Edward to the show, just to see the show? And then I thought, oh my God, Edward has never met Ritchie. What if I could get those two guys together? So that's my thought process. So unbeknownst to me, Edward had encountered Richie back when they were still playing clubs. He was in the Rainbow. Richie was there with John Bonham. And these are two of the less nice people in the world. I hate to say that about John. He's gone.
Oh, man.
John could be a pretty mean person. I was out on the road with Zeppelin, and you walked real quietly when John was around. I mean, they told me, they really told me this, Zeppelin's people, don't make eye contact with John and never speak to him. And I thought they were goofing. Wow. I thought, okay, look, I know he could be an angry young man, but, you know, come on. But they were right. You just didn't fuck with John. Anyway, both those guys are there at the Starwood. Edward sees them. Edward's obviously a monster Zeppelin fan, you know, loves Page's playing. Walks over, and Richie dismisses him, hand out of foot. John insults him. I mean, some nasty things to him, you know, really nasty. I did not know this. Edward never told me this. He's at my house, and he sees a picture. I have my walls are covered. Well, you can see a little bit here. My walls are covered. In fact, there's, where am I? Right there. That's, can you guys see that picture?
Yeah.
That's Richie and me. That's 74. I'm sorry, 75 with Rainbow. There were pictures on the walls. I had interviewed Richie just a few months actually before meeting Edward, and he looks at a picture and he sees Richie, and he doesn't say anything, you know, that he had met him. I go, oh, okay, you know. Fast forward, tonight at the concert, we drive down there, it was John Cougar. It was John Cougar, Randy Hansen, who was that Hendrix imitator, who did an amazing job, and Rainbow. And so we get there, and we miss John Cougar, and we expect Randy Hansen to come on, the middle act. And the lights go down, and Richie comes on. And we're going, what the hell? And Richie goes through his set, and then Randy comes on and plays in the headlining spot. I could not understand it. We go backstage afterwards to see Randy. Edward had met Randy a week before. Randy had played the Whiskey. And we go back there, and I go, Randy, what the hell was that? He goes, oh, Richie was upset. He said that he couldn't follow me. I don't know if that's the truth. That's what Randy told me. Randy had played a couple shows. I think he played a show previously at Oakland, opening for Richie. And he said he saw Richie in a corner, you know, kind of slumped over a sink, you know, in a kind of like a defeated posture, like, oh, this Randy Hansen dude. Look, I don't know if that's true. That's Randy Hansen's story. All I do know is that I've seen 1,000 rock and roll shows, and I've never seen the headliner go on second. So Richie was upset about something. And all I can think about is, okay, well, we're going to an after hours party, and I'm going to introduce Ed to Richie. And Richie is so distraught that he didn't even go on as the headlining act. And I'm going to introduce Edward to Richie, and what's going to happen? So all those things are going through my head. We go to the after hours party, after concert, which was at the Queen Mary, which is a huge ocean liner, which back in the day was an ocean liner. Now it had been relegated to like it was like a place where you would hold weddings. And they had banquet halls, and you could have parties there. And the label threw an after concert party for Richie, for Rainbow. So we go, and you walk up like a little plank, like you see on Fantasy Island. You know, you walk onto the ship, you know, and there's a bouncer there with a clipboard. And my first thought was, maybe I'll be lucky, and my name's not on the list. We'll have to turn around and drive home, you know. And then I thought, oh, my God, what an embarrassment that would be. And I'm here with Edward, and my name's on the list. That would be worse than, you know, going in there and having some encounter with Richie. And indeed, that happened. So my name's on the list. We go in. Ed gets a drink. I'm looking around, you know, and I see Richie. And he sees me. And again, I'd interviewed him just a couple of months before. And I think he kind of recognizes me. And I'm pretty positive he recognizes this guy I'm walking with. So we walk over, and I go, hi, Richie, Steve Rosen from Guitar Player Magazine. How are you? You know, and kind of shakes my hand, you know. And he's kind of, you know, mad dogging Ed, you know, he's kind of looking at Ed. And I'm thinking, this is not going to be good. And sure enough, you know, I go, Richie, Edward Van Halen, Ed, Richie Blackmore. And Edward extends his hand. And I don't think Richie shook it. And if he did, it was a cursory shake at best. And Richie looks at him, you know, and gives you that mean, sarcastic look and goes, I know you. And says, you play guitar, right? And I'm shrinking and thinking, oh my God, this is not happening. And I'm looking at Ed and I know that he's hurt. I mean, look, man, anybody would be hurt. You can be Edward Van Halen and still be hurt. You know, you can be, you know, Picasso and have Da Vinci insult you. I mean, I realize I'm mixing errors here, but you get the picture. But Edward acted like as if it didn't matter to him. I know it hurt him. And so we just, you know, we stood there and just basically walked away and Ed had a drink and we left. And I was afraid to bring it up. You know, I didn't know if Ed was going to be pissed at me, he was going to be mad at me. And again, this whole time, I never knew that he had already met Richie. Had I known that, I never would have made that introduction. But yes, that was Edward meeting Richie. You know, strange. You know, Ed used to bring up Richie's name once in a while in our discussions. I never heard him bring up Richie's name again in the rest of the time that I spent with him, you know. It's a shame. I mean, I really thought, you know, it was kind of like, you know, the Young Turk, the New Guard, you know, talking to the classic guy, the Strat guys. My God, they had so much in common. You know, they were on the same label. They played the same kinds of guitars. They used the same kinds of amps. They both loved the shuffle thing, you know. Richie just, you know, and I write in the book, Richie was never happy unless everybody around him was unhappy. And it was really true, man. I mean, he treated me like shit on more than one occasion, treated his band guys like shit. They couldn't deal with him anymore, you know. But, yeah.
I mean, egos running wild, and egos running wild in the rock community, man. It's a tale as old as time. Even in my, you know, little like local scene, it runs rampant, and it's like, stop it, everyone, stop, please. But you get, as you say, two personalities like that, and they have so many similarities, as you pointed out. He's like, oh, they should be the best of friends. Sometimes two personalities so similar collide, and so that's what it sounded like. But it also sounds like Richie was kind of a prick. So
Richie was kind of a prick, and you know, that night, for whatever reason that he didn't headline, I mean, obviously that didn't help. And with Richie, I mean, look, this is my interpretation. I think Richie read the writing on the wall. He saw this kid standing in front of him and thought, you know, that was me, you know, 20 years ago or 30 years ago, you know, and this is the new generation. Look, and I wrote in the book, I don't want to take away anything from Richie Blackmore as a guitar player, as a songwriter, you know, all that stuff. I mean, I think he's unsung. As much as we talk about Richie, I mean, you really don't hear Richie being spoken about, you know, when conversations come up with Hendrix or Page and Beck and Clapton and, you know, Ed. I mean, Richie's never talked about it. I mean, to my mind, man, my God, those riffs that he created, that Strat sound, I mean, nobody played like him. Nobody wrote like him. And Purple were one of the biggest freaking bands in the world, man. I mean, they're one of the archetypes for heavy metal, right? So I take nothing away from him on that level. You know, if you get to just let go just a little bit, you know, but hey,
there's a saying, bad gas travels fast in a small town. And, the music community, I feel like, is kind of a small town, especially when you achieve a certain status. And I don't, maybe there's a correlation with the fact that he is who he is, or was who he was. And then, you know, when you got such a bad reputation, it gets around people. And then suddenly nobody wants to talk about you. Nobody wants to have anything to do with you. So like maybe that the reason why his name isn't brought up more in those like guitar player conversations. Maybe that has something to do with it. Or maybe I am willing to believe that story that he decided I am not following Eddie Van Halen after hearing him. It's like, nope, not doing that. I'm willing to believe that's probably accurate because, I mean, it's Eddie Van Halen. And especially if you have no idea what he sounds like, who he is, and then he just at that period of time just comes out the gate just swinging. Get out of the way. Get out of the way. And if you feel like the old guard has passed and you are part of the old guard, then step aside for the new guard. And I get it. That's, again, we're talking about egos. And sometimes that's a hard pill to swallow for a lot of people, entertainers especially. So on one hand, I feel you, Richie. But on the other hand, you brought it on yourself, bro. But hey,
the bottom line, the thing I couldn't understand is that Richie had nothing to prove to anybody. Like I said, I mean, you know, look, man, I mean, In Rock, Machine Head, Fireball, Burn, those are some of the greatest guitar rock records I've ever heard. They were, you know, templates for everything that came afterwards. So yeah, somehow, I don't know. Yeah, he was unnerved by that. Sad, you know. It's sad, and then he kind of pursued that Renaissance Baroque thing he does. Look, man, it's his life; he can do whatever he wants. But I really never understood that one. And I've talked to guys who, you know, were interviewing him, and he says up front, "I will not talk about Deep Purple." And that's something, man, if I would talk to an artist and they say, well, I'm not going to talk about my old stuff. It's like, well, that's all I want to talk about, because usually the old stuff is the cool stuff. You know, I mean, look, not all the time, but you know, it's like somebody would say that to me and it's like my whole mood is gone. It's like, oh my God, we really got to talk about the new record. You know, I mean, I'm being a little glib about it, but it happened quite a bit, you know, where guys just were reluctant, and which I couldn't really understand, because I mean that's what they did. They created that. You know, why run from it? Look, I understand they're there to talk about a new record, but not to want to talk about their past at all is. I found it most distasteful.
Yeah. And speaking, I guess, from like on a creative side, maybe there's a lot of insecurities with a lot of those guys who felt that way. Like, I don't want to talk about my past. We're talking about right now. And it's like, well, why would you just dismiss what came before? And a lot of that probably because if they wrote an album previously that was just so impactful and meant a lot to people, that's what people want to talk about. It's like, okay, great. It might have given some artists the idea that, oh God, I'm a one trick pony. This is what I'm going to be remembered for. Not what I like, a continuous legacy, just, you know, the things that I've done in the past. And I mean, not just for musicians, like I'm sure a lot of people would feel that way about certain things. So maybe that comes into play. Or maybe just, I don't know, maybe some dudes just kind of get sick of talking about one thing all the time. I don't know. But I agree with you, though. It's like, we can talk about the new stuff, but I'd rather go back and like, let's acknowledge this, because maybe I have a different perspective than you've heard before. And then, you know, and maybe that is another thing, too. We've heard it all before. It's like, yes, I've talked about that album. I don't want to talk about that anymore. I won't talk about this previous band. It's like, well, that previous band put you on the map, so you sure you don't want to talk a little bit about it? Like, no. Like, all right, well, okay. It's like, good luck on your future endeavors, but it happens like that.
To that point, Mark, Scott asked a question a while ago I didn't get in yet that Steven already actually kind of answered. What was your first impression of Van Halen's debut album when you first heard it? You already kind of answered that, but what do you think about that album now? Like, did it grow on you over time, or?
It definitely grew on me, and I realized how amazing the his guitar sound was. I mean, that was we've never heard anything like that, you know. I mean, it didn't sound like Rich's guitar. It didn't sound like Hendrix's guitar. It was big and had, you know, it had depth to it. It was overdriven, and yet you could hear the articulation in every single note. that he played, man. And you know, that all came from Edward, you know, the other thing that made him obviously so unique, you know, was building his own guitars and playing his own guitars. I mean, mm-hmm. Ed felt he really couldn't find that sound he wanted out of a Strat, right? We know this, or Les Paul. So he brings those two together. The question I always had, did he have this sound in his head? You know, did he have the Brown sound in his head? And he was building an instrument to sort of create that sound? Or did he build the guitar and start playing it and then realize what the sound was? And did that point him in a direction? Oh, this is my sound, you know, that I've created, you know, building my own guitars and stuff. You know, I've always wanted, you know, was the chicken or the egg first? But yeah. in referring to the first record, yeah, man, that record is, it's a pretty unbelievable record. You know, it's that Cream approach. Well, it's the Cream live approach, because actually on those early Cream records, Eric was overdubbing rhythm tracks and stuff in the solos. But you know, it's just a trio. And Ed talks about, you know, he didn't know that he could overdub and, you know, all that stuff. And when they told him that he had to overdub, you know, he said, well, can I just play like I play live, you know? So, you know, you hear that remarkable style, you know, not like Hendrix, but that, you know, playing the lead, the accompaniment, the rhythm thing, the little noodle fills, you know, all in one pass. I mean, that's unbelievable. You know, and listening to the record was amazing. And watching him in concert was amazing. And, you know, I had the rare opportunity of him, you know, coming over to my pad, to the Little Hollywood Hills guest house, you know, and he'd pick up one of my guitars. I had a Strat, and he'd pick it up, you know, and he'd play it acoustically, and he'd play me those riffs, you know, not so much the first record, though I did ask him about some of that stuff. I asked him about the solo, and You Really Got Me in that last amazing kind of that mournful note that he hits, you know, and he plays the solo. But you know, he would come over and play me roughs of the albums before they came out, which were only, I'm pretty positive it was only guitar and drums. There might've been bass, but I don't think so. I know there were no vocals, and I know they were unmixed, unmastered, and not sequenced. And he'd come over and he'd play the cassette for me. We go listen in his car, and he cranked that fucker up to 11, you know, and he's got the window shut, you know, and he's smoking a cigarette, and I'm choking and gasping for breath, you know, and the thing is fucking cranked, and my ears are bleeding, and it's unbelievable listening to all this guitar music. And then we go upstairs, and he picks up my guitar. He goes, yeah, man, that's what I did on, you know, Bottoms Up. That's what I did on Romeo's Life, whatever. And you watch him from 3 feet away, and the guitar isn't amplified, and you see how his fingers rest on the neck, and he's sitting on the couch, and you see how fucking long his fingers are, man, and you see the amazing way he holds a pick, and you know, then he goes to the right, the middle on the thumb, and he does the flutter thing, and the way it just so seamlessly, you know, flies between the chords. You know, and what struck me, and another reason why on that first record, all those notes are articulated, was his attack was really heavy. His left hand was pretty light, but his, you know, right hand, you think, oh, he was just, you know, kind of touching the strings, man, he was digging into those strings, really heavily. So, you know, you're watching that, it was just unbelievable. That record was unbelievable, and it changed everything. You know, everybody was chasing that tone after Edward. Nobody ever got it. But yeah, man, that was a game changer. You know, that was like the first Hendrix record. That was like, for me anyway, the Truth record, you know, the first Jeff Beck record, you know, the first Zeppelin record. That was, you know, things would never be the same after that one.
Oh, yeah. We talk a lot on the show about how, or that rather, Eddie's sound is so often imitated, but absolutely never duplicated, because you can't play, nobody can play like him. And I think you bring up a really interesting question. We probably discussed it on the show in previous episodes, but like, what came first? Did he have the sound in his brain and manifest it? Or did he like, did he just find it whilst trying, you know, it just kind of happened. And then once he found that tone, set him on the path. I'm willing to believe probably a little bit of both. Maybe in his brain, he heard the riffs. He's like, okay, it sounds cool like that, but like, let me see if I can bring that out. And then on his journey, he's like, whoa, wait a minute. Let me turn this down. Let me turn this way, way up. Aha, there it is. Brown sound. I could be off base on that, but I like to believe just a little bit of both. You have a really intriguing chapter in the book called like How to Play Guitar Like Eddie Van Halen in One Not So Easy Lesson. And, you know, I'll let the readers read it. But can you give like a little small little premise as to what readers can expect with that one in particular?
Right. So it might have been one of Edward's trips where he would just show up and he'd just knock on the door. And I love when he did that, you know. Didn't call, he'd just show up, you know, and he'd come bounding in. Hey, man, got anything to eat? Got any potato chips, you know? And of course, he had this cigarette. And I also famously write in there, I was susceptible to migraines back then. And if anyone's had a migraine, they know that it's the worst pain in the world. And one of the worst things for a migraine, or the thing that can trigger a migraine faster than anything, is cigarette smoke. So I'm around him and he's never without a cigarette. Unbelievably, in all the time I was with him, I never got a migraine. But he would come in the house, you know, man, and he's smoking. And part of me wants to say, Ed, could you put this?
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Cigarette out, or could you smoke outside? And it's like, I never said that. It's like, I couldn't bring myself to tell Edward Van Halen to go outside and smoke a cigarette. You know, hypocrite that I was, like, I couldn't do it, you know. So he'd be smoking, you know. He'd pick up my guitar. And I had two guitars. Pretty much most of the time, I had a Strat, a 66 Strat that I write about, and I had a Les Paul Deluxe. And they were both nice guitars. I mean, I sounded like shit on them, but they were good guitars. you know, so he picked it up and he starts playing, you know, and he starts doing his, you know, the tapping thing, and I'm watching him, you know, and he gets that triplet feel going, you know, and that's the whole key to it, you know. So something in me, and I'll be honest, you know, and I write about it, you know, Edward was probably doing some lines and I was probably joining him. And, you know, I was probably fucked up. And so I might have walked over and picked up the Les Paul, because that's the only way I would have done it. I mean, there's no way I would have been straight and gone to pick up the guitar and go, oh, Ed, let's jam, you know, let's play. You know, I mean, I could never do that. So I have the guitar in my hand, and I'm watching him do the triplets, and I'm trying to copy what he's doing. I wasn't a horrible guitar player. You know, I mean, I could play, and I tried as hard as I could, you know, he's doing this triplet, you know, and he's doing it up and down the neck, and he's changing fingers, you know, and I'm trying to do it. And I said, Ed, what are you doing? And so he would slow it down, and I try to do it. And he goes, oh, you're doing it backwards. And I couldn't even understand what he was backwards. I didn't even know what that meant. I mean, I couldn't have played the thing backwards if I tried. He goes, you're doing it backwards. I go, what does that mean? He goes, Well, it depends where you're counting one, and that completely befuddled me. So I just sat there, you know, kept going, you know, kept trying to do it and tried to do it. And I think I did it like once or twice. So he goes, yeah, that's it. I go, yeah, I got it, didn't I? He goes, yeah, that was good. The thing with Edward was, look, man, he knew what kind of a guitar player I was, you know. And he said once, oh, you're a good guitar player. You understand guitar playing. And I did. You know, I mean, I had bands. I was not a great guitar player. But I understood chords, you know, and I could come up with interesting chords. You know, I could play decent solos. I knew just enough not to be horrible. And he knew that. But the thing about Edward, you know, he saw how hard, and I was, man, I wanted to master that triplet. I wanted to get the feel for it, the right feel. And he saw how hard I was trying. And that meant a lot to him. And when I finally got it, he rewarded me. He knew. I mean, I think he knew that, you know, by him saying, yeah, man, that was it. That was good. What that would mean to me, what that would mean to any guitar player. I mean,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Any of you guys. I mean, any guitar player sitting in the room, everybody goes, yeah, that's good. My God, that would be everything. There was a lot of the teacher in Edward, you know. He could have said, oh, man, that's wrong. You know, you're doing it wrong. That, you know, don't do that. I mean, I would have shriveled up. You know, I would have put the guitar back in the stand and just sat there. I mean, it would have been humiliating, would have been crushing. But he never, ever did that, ever. You know, he encouraged me. And I think he encouraged the people around him as well. He respected the fact that I tried as hard as I could to get it right. The fact that I couldn't get it right, it really made no difference to him. With Edward, and I write about this, it was always about respect. And if he felt he was being disrespected, that was like the worst thing you could do. You know, you say, Ed, that was a shitty solo, or Ed, you know, you didn't play very well that night. Yeah, he was probably a bit upset, but okay. But if you disrespected him, if you made it feel like you were disrespecting his art, or you didn't care enough, or you weren't working hard enough, that upset him. And specifically, and I don't want to get into it because I write about it, but, you know, sometimes the other guys in the band didn't bring to the music what he felt they should be bringing. And to Ed, that translated as disrespect. And it had nothing to do with those guys as musicians, as singers or bass players. It had nothing to do with that. It was the fact that they didn't... They weren't trying hard enough, and to Edward, that was there was no excuse for that. Disrespect Edward, and he never forgot it. So with Edward, that was everything. But on the other side of that, he always rewarded that, you know. And he'd say nice things, and he'd be complimentary and supportive, and he wanted to push you, man. He wanted you to be a better player. So he was a dichotomy in a lot of ways. Trying to play guitar like Ed in one lesson. Yeah, I almost got it. You know? I had 10,000 more lessons than I might have had, the triplet thing down.
Yeah, it sounds to me like he had his own method of playing and counting. So, like, it's kudos to you for like keeping up, and then him actually going like, yeah, that's it, you're good. Because it's like, if you were able to somehow figure out his method then and his system, like that's not an easy feat. So, you know, whatever you did, kudos. Our buddy Tom asks, you mentioned a 2-hour interview with Michael Anthony during the 5150 tour. Did they talk off the record about Eddie's feelings about his sound or playing?
Honestly, Tom, it's hard to remember. I don't think so, because I was really that was an interview for what was going to be the original book. So this is like 85, 86. You know, I approached Edward. I said, Edward, I want to write your life story. He said, yes, you can write my life story. So I started interviewing, you know, all kinds of people, as friends, bandmates, you know, guys he'd been in bands with earlier, excuse me, guys were promoting, you know, local Pasadena shows, everybody I could find really that I thought had something important to say. And of course, I wanted to sit down with Michael. So we sat over the course of 2 days, you know, talked for a couple hours. It was more about Michael's participation, really. He did actually talk a little bit about, you know, recording with Ed and how it was really challenging playing some of the bass parts with Ed, you know, because his timing on stuff was so weird. But I can't really remember, you know, talking about Ed's, you know, guitar sound or how he created it. I mean, it might have been there. I can't remember. I just put up a the first part of an interview with Zeke Clark, and that's pretty cool. I mean, that's pretty a pretty in-depth dive into Edward's gear at the time. And that might, you know, answer some of your questions and help you, you know, decode how Ed was maybe getting some of those sounds and stuff. Yeah.
Right on. You speak about, yeah, I mean, the book is called Tone Chaser, and for good reason. Is there a particular, and maybe this is an unfair question, but I'll ask it anyway. Is there a particular album where you think, that right there, to me, in my brain, is the quintessential tone slash, you know, sound of Eddie Van Halen, like true to its core? Is there a particular album that stands out where you're like, that's the one?
I'm sure most people would probably answer the first or second records, I'm guessing.
Probably.
And those are remarkable records. You know, to digress peripherally just for a minute, I can tell you that Edward was happiest on those first two records, those first two tours. It was all new to him. You know, he was this kid who'd gone playing the Whiskey and you know, going on a tour with Sabbath and Journey, and then playing the Day on the Green show, which is where that picture of me with the haircut and the shorts came from, you know. So, I mean, it was all new to him, and he was happy back then, man. And it's reflected in his playing. I mean, his playing is just, you know, so full of life on those records, and his playing is amazing. In answer to your question, Mark, fair warning. You know, Edward finally has the time to really explore the guitar and what it can do on record. So we hear multiple layers of guitars, multi-tracking. It had never been that deep before at all. You know, little noodle lines that would come in over a second verse to build a verse. You know, his solos, I just thought they were just unbelievable. Yeah, to me, that was definitive Van Halen. You know, I characterized it, you know, when Ed and I were talking in one of the interviews, I can't remember which one. And I said, Ed, you know, were you an angry young man that day you recorded? You know, it was a particular solo. And he goes, and he laughed. I mean, laughed in a good way. He goes, why would you say that? Why? Ed, that solo sounds really angry. He goes, no, I don't think so. You know, a lot of people typify the album as dark. I mean, it was. I mean, we all have that sense of it. I mean, certainly there was that certain esprit that Van Halen had, but that was a pretty dark record. You know, a lot of minor sounding riffs and, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah, his playing was just amazing, man. And we really hear Edward as orchestrator and arranger and you know, putting the parts over each other, and the way he would build his verses, you know, and it might just be some little accent he would do, you know, on one of his fills. I mean, that is really sophisticated songwriting in my mind. I mean, that's like unbelievable, you know. And I think with Ed, it was just, it was a sense, you know, I mean, I don't know if he was consciously thinking, how can I build the second verse? But I think, you know, part of his brain was thinking about that, you know. He knew there was going to be a vocal going over it, and he wanted, you know, the momentum to build in the song. You know, pretty unbelievable, you know. And he also told me he never worked as hard on any record as he did on that one. He got really sick.
Wow.
I mean, really sick. He lost, he said, like 40 pounds. He was down to like 120 pounds. He said he developed an ulcer And he said he had to take Maalox for it. And when he told me that, I kind of chuckled. Not that he had an ulcer, but my brother, if you get upset stomach a lot, Maalox is one of these things that you take. It's like, you know, drinking chalk, you know. So I knew about it, and I only chuckled because my brother had it by the box fold. I mean, my brother used to take that stuff because he'd get like upset stomach, and, you know, that's why I chuckled. Ed said, "No, man, you don't believe me. Go talk to the doctor." You know, like, and that was so strange. Like, I would laugh because he told me he had an ulcer. It was strange, you know. Sometimes his reactions. I had to really sometimes be careful how I reacted or what I said to him, you know, or if he said something, you know. A lot of times, and I recognize this as a trait that I've done since I started doing interviews back in 1973, I have like this weird nervous chuckle. And it's not me laughing because somebody has necessarily said something funny, but I'm laughing because it's me being so fucking nervous. It's like, that's my defense thing.
Yeah.
Oh, you use a Fender heavies. Oh, you play a Strat, you know, and sometimes I would do that and he'd go, "No, really, I'm serious." When I wasn't laughing at anything he said, I was laughing because of the nerves, you know. So, you know, it was kind of this tightrope walking thing a lot of times with Edward. I mean, it really was.
Sure. You don't want to be like misinterpreted, or you don't want him misinterpreting like what you're saying, or like the laugh as in like, I'm laughing at you, and you're like, no, I'm laughing. I'm laughing with you technically, even though you're not laughing. But this is just a tick. It's a tick. It's not, has nothing to do with what you're saying. I promise. I get that for sure. So
Now we should mention.
Yeah,
we should mention the book one more time, Tone Chaser, by Steve Rosen. You can get your copy at tonechaserbook.com and wherever you get your books from. Steven, as we're kind of winding down here, our time here tonight, I wanted you to just talk a little bit about how this project kind of changed for you. Because originally in the mid-80s, you approached Edward about doing his authorized biography. And then, you know, that kind of fell by the wayside in the 90s. Then obviously that changed in 2000. Maybe just talk about the shift that this project took for you.
Right, exactly. So I approached Edward, I want to write your life story. He says, yes, I start working on it. I probably worked on it for about a good 3 years. And I, you know, would try to get Edward to sit down, even though I had interviewed him a fair amount. It was more the, you know, the guitar-centric interviews, you know, for Guitar World, or I was writing for some Japanese magazines, Player Magazine. You know, Edward was God in Japan. They wanted stories. And I was also writing for European magazines. So it was more, you know, based around guitars and that kind of thing. I wanted to sit down with Ed and talk about his family and what was it like growing up in the Netherlands. And, you know, were you a good student? You know, I mean, did you read any books, Edward? Why did you start smoking when you were 13? Did you go and hang out with your dad when he was playing? And, you know, who were your friends? And did you ride a bicycle? I mean, all these questions, you know, that we'll never know now. We'll never have answers. I mean, really, the only one who knows the answer to that really is probably Alex. I mean, unless he has some relatives, you know, back in Europe, and they must be very old by now. Anyway, so my friendship with Edward ends in 2003. I was angry, you know. I don't want to go into details. I don't want to give away the ending of the book, but I was mad. So for a lot of years, I really didn't think about him, or I tried not to think about him. But the years would go by, and, you know, I'd hear that, you know, Van Halen came out the record, or they were touring again with Dave, which I found just absolutely impossible to believe. And if you read the book, you'll understand why I think that way. And, you know, off and on, I would think about that book that never happened, which I always looked on as a failure on my part. I thought that book should have happened. I knew how important that book was going to be, but I could never quite make it happen. So the years go by. In 2020, I guess I've been thinking about it more seriously. some friends said, man, you know, you should write that book. You should write a book. Why don't you write the book about Edward? And honestly, there were several things that stopped me. One, I knew how much unbelievable work it was going to be. And, you know, I it was a daunting task. Two, maybe there was still a part of me that, you know, I still had this bad taste in my mouth. You know, I don't want to write a book about Edward Van Halen. And three, and probably more poignantly, I honestly didn't know if I was able or capable of writing the great book about Edward that I wanted it to be. I wanted to write a book that was where the words were as great as Edward was a guitar player. You know what I mean? I wanted the words mm-hmm. to dance off the page. I wanted it to be an incredible book. I mean, all authors want that, but this had to be an amazing book. It had to live up to who this person was. And I didn't know if I was capable of doing that, you know, either as a journalist, you know, my memories, you know, by then we're talking 40 plus years later. So anyway, I sit down, it's August 24th, and I remember the day because it was my birthday, and maybe it was specifically on that day. I sit down and I start typing, and I had a vague notion in my head. You know, it was going to be something about Edward. I didn't really know. And I'm writing, and what came out was sort of that first paragraph that you read in the intro. And I looked at it, and I go, wow, that's not bad. That's cool. I've never read anything like that. You know, that's different. And the next morning I would come in and my cat Arpeggio, who I write about in the book, would wake me up at 3 o'clock in the morning. And instead of trying to go back to sleep, I'd go into my little office and I'd write. So from 3 a.m. or 2 a.m. until like 8 or 9 when the sun was up, I would write. And I did that every day. And slowly, you know, the voice, I could find the voice, you know, this voice that I was looking for. And the chapters would come together and I was listening to the cassettes. And those were amazing to hear again for the first time, literally in, you know, decades. I had never listened to them since the one and only time I'd listened to them, some of them, when I was writing the original interviews back in the day. So I hadn't heard them, and I'm listening to them. I go, oh, my God, that's right. Ed came over that day. And, that's when he was playing me the songs off the third record. And, yeah, man, you know, he smoked. And I gave him some potato chips, or I gave him a Slender bar or something. And, you know, I hear all this stuff and all these memories come back. So in a long answer to a short question, Corey, yeah, man, it just sort of, you know, 17 years later, it was there and it was kind of gnawing at me. And as much as anything, I knew that if I did not write this book, that I would have really disappointed myself. I would have thought, you fucking chicken shit, you know? You didn't even make the attempt, you know? Maybe you had written it and nobody reads it. Okay, but at least you could say you tried, you know? So if I hadn't done that, you know, I think about it now, I go, wow, that would have been pathetic, honestly. Again, you know, people have read it and hopefully they've gotten some joy out of it, you know, and I think maybe none of those people would have read it. And, you know, if they've learned something about it, they wouldn't have learned anything if the book had to happen, you know. And, you know, I don't know, maybe these are selfish reasons, but for all these different reasons, I sat down and did it, and it was hard. It was really hard, you know, and 14 months later, it was done. And I thought I'd written a good book. I thought I'd written a really good book, but I didn't know, right? You write a song, you're a great songwriter. You're staying in your bedroom, right? Until you hear somebody else hears it and go, oh, that's not a very good song, Mark. You know, write something up. You know what I mean? So, you know.
Oh, I've heard that many times before.
Exactly. So, you know, it was a different book, and I recognized that. And I thought, it's the best book I could have written, you know, so. Thank goodness.
But daunting task, though. I mean, like you nailed it when you said like it had to be something that was going to be fantastic, you know, to live up to Eddie's standards. And yeah, that's like that is if I'm a writer, that's going through my brain the whole time. Like, it's just like, how do I possibly put into words, you know, who this person is, like who it means to me, you know, correlate the music, the personification. Like, how do I do that? How do I make that happen? I got to tell you, as daunting of a task as I'm sure it was, and as you say, like it went through different iterations and everything until finally Tone Chaser is your final product. I think this is exactly the kind of story that you were supposed to tell. Again, we'll bring it back to like things happen for a reason. Like, yeah, here's the reason. Like you didn't write the autobiography like intended, the life story as it were, as intended, because you weren't supposed to write it that way. Not like that. You were supposed to write it like Tone Chaser. And because like this, it just feels so personal, and it feels it's almost like at least for me when I was reading it, is I feel like almost like a voyeur just in the room while you guys, especially I really love that that guitar lesson chapter. I really do. Just like, because you just like, you go through like so many details that I didn't even realize, like, do I need to read this? Like, no, I do. I do need to read. I need to take all this in. And it just made me feel like such like to be a fly on the wall just for that interaction alone. But I mean, for all of it. And you just and it helps because you knew the man personally and for so many years, and it really does come through in the writing. So just so as you know, it's like I think very much so, in spite of where you were at the time, as opposed to like no, I'm not gonna write the book for my reasons here, I think you're right. You it would have plagued you. I think it would have played you like, why didn't I just do it? But you didn't do it because you had to write it this way. So I think it's a humongous kudos to the way the narrative is presented through Tone Chaser. And I'm glad that you took a step back and you took the time that you needed to take in order to tell the story in this particular way. So just to throw that out there. But before we go, and then before we let you go, Scott Monroe says, regarding Van Halen's split with David Lee Roth, do you think, as Ted Templeman did, that Van Halen was not Van Halen without David Lee Roth fronting? Or do you think the Sammy era was an important part of Eddie and the band's growth? And Scott, stepping on my toes, because I was gonna finish out this talk with which camp are you, because we have to ask, because we get attacked from people that don't even like the show, but they want to, you know, chime in and be like, it's David Lee Roth or it's not Van Halen, just, you know, fuck off. I'm like, okay, so where do you stand on that there, Steve?
Well, Mark, I'm going to incur the wrath of Evie. And I write about it in the book, and I'm pretty honest about it. I recognize Dave's importance in that band. Without Dave, there is Van Halen, right? Edward wasn't going to sing. Edward didn't have that kind of outsized ego. Edward needed Dave. I was simply never a fan of Dave singing. And... you know, man, that just comes from a place. And again, I write about it in the book. You know, I grew up listening to, you know, singer. I mean, I was listening to Rod Stewart and Jack Bruce and Roger Daltrey and Gary Brooker from Procol Harum, Paul Rogers. You know, those are the singers I was listening to. And Dave was just out of my bailiwick, you know. It just didn't sit right with me. So I was never a fan of Dave's singing. And to be honest, I think that Sammy was technically a better singer, but I was never a fan of Sammy's singing. I love the I love the first Montrose record. And I think that's the best singing Sammy ever did. So yes, man, you know, I'm going to have my face burned in effigy by the David fans and the Sammy fans. I don't know. I look, I can't argue with the success of the band with either singer. You know, the purist is always going to say it was the David Lee Roth era, those first six records. I understand that. I mean, Sammy allowed Edward to become a more expansive songwriter. You know, his range was bigger, right? There's more keyboards coming in. The changes are getting a little bit more complex. You know, if you can write those kinds of changes because Sammy can sing over those changes. I just never thought they matched up to Edward's guitar playing and his writing. Sorry, guys. Nothing personal, you know.
Fair enough.
Michael is a wonderful guy, and you know, I'd love to send him a book. I'm sure he, you know, is mad at me, and you know, Dave, you know, I could have lied about it. I didn't want to lie about it. In the same way, I said that Jeff Beck was my favorite guitar player. Edward was certainly in the top five, but Jeff was my favorite guitar player because that's what I grew up listening to. I saw Jeff Beck group at the Shrine, you know, with Rod Stewart. That was mind-blowing to me, and the Truth and the Beckola record. So that's what I was listening to, and that's what I was measuring stuff by. And so when I heard that first Van Halen record, I'm thinking, okay, you know, Wheels of Fire, Truth, first Zeppelin record, Salty Dog by Procol Harum, you know, Free at Last. I mean, that's my yardstick, man. That's where I set, you know, and you had better, if you didn't reach it, then okay, you're not as good as them. So, you know, that snob thing again, you know, it took a minute to understand that Edward was, you know, on the other side of all of that, he was creating this new yardstick for everything to be measured against. But yeah, that was my feelings about, you know, Dave and Sammy. And sorry, guys, don't be angry. Don't trash the
world. Oh, no.
You and I will be on that island together because I have
heard it here first.
Yeah, I've been saying it since day one of this show, and I have been attacked mercilessly for it. I have always maintained, while I love David Lee Roth and the contributions, obviously you don't get Van Halen without him, I have always maintained Sammy Hagar is the better technical singer, the better vocalist. In our journey, I might have at one point said he probably writes better songs, but in our journey so far through Van Halen, like, I don't know, like he's written some real bad ones too. Doesn't diminish his vocal ability at all. But I've always maintained, I was like, look, Dave can be the front man that you all imagine in your mind when you think about Van Halen. However, when it comes to every position from a technicality standpoint, vocals wise, you cannot touch Sammy. Like, Dave can't touch Sammy. Gary can't touch Sammy. Like, it's Sammy. But I will agree with you, though. Was he better in Montrose? Is like, well, it's hard for me to say yes, even though it's probably technically true. It's hard for me to say yes just because, like, the Sammy era of Van Halen is, like, so personal to me. But it is what it is. And again, and I have to point this out every time, I'm not dissing David Lee Roth, you guys. I'm not. So calm down. And Steve is not dissing David Lee Roth. He's just saying, Sammy was the better singer.
And it's strange. I'm sorry to interrupt real quick.
No, go ahead.
So David's left the band, and Edward's looking for a singer. He leaves a phone message. I wasn't home. Why wasn't I home? Hey, Steve, Sammy's voice to my music, you know, you won't believe it. He was really excited about Sammy coming in the band. However, he said to me, which I couldn't understand, he hated Sammy's writing. And I thought he was talking about somebody else. I go, oh, who's that? He goes, Sammy. He goes, I hate his writing. He says, he writes these songs. He's talking about Sammy's solo, you know, his solo stuff. Says he writes these songs, he says, and his arrangements are so weird. He says, but I like his singing, but he didn't like his writing, which I can never understand because Sammy's coming into the band as a songwriter and a singer, but he never was a fan of Sammy's writing. And that was I mean, there's something about, You know, Sammy, if you hear this, man, you've always been great with me. And there was just something about Sammy's solo stuff. It was always a little pretentious. I don't know, man. It just didn't. I don't know what it was. I shouldn't be saying those things. Look, man, the guy's a gifted guy. You know, he made a shitload of money. He sold tequila. He's got his own club. He's famous. You know, my comments mean nothing, you know. So I don't know.
Oh, I'm sure he'll take it in stride. And, you know, it's like, but look, and you'll not hear a huge argument out of Corey and myself when in terms of Sammy's writing, like I alluded to during this journey, this rediscovery, if you will, really analyzing some of their songwriting structure. And with Sammy, when he nails it, he nails it. But then he has a few duds. Just with his not his vocal ability, but his lyrics, especially, like, I won't even mention them just because I don't want to give Corey the satisfaction, but there's a few that are just not great. And I have to imagine if Eddie had even said way back then, like, his writing's weird, I don't like it, he was probably not crazy about some of the duds I'm thinking about here. So that's just a funny caveat. But winding down, you guys, those are just but a tip of the iceberg when it comes to the stories that Steve tells in this book, Tone Chaser. Steve, thank you so much for sending us the book. Thank you so much for joining us, talking about it, sharing your experience with Eddie, with the world now, with this book. Only time will tell if we stand the test of time. You love that line, Scott. You love it. Don't that's your Twitter bio. Don't lie. Anyway, as I was saying, you guys really need all of our listeners, despite what camp they are, if they're on the Roth camp or the Sammy camp. We are all on the camp of Eddie Van Halen, and they would be very, very curious to. Very, very interested to hear and to read all of the interactions that you had with Eddie, the stories that you have to tell. It's a must for you guys who are very big Eddie Van Halen fans. So, Steve, before we let you go, please tell the people where they can find the book, and then what else you got going on? Anything else you want to plug?
So you can find the book on my site, tonechaserbook.com. You can also find it on Amazon, eBay, Reverb, and Etsy. So if anybody's out there on Etsy looking for a purse, go check out my book. and I would ask one thing of you guys. If you guys could leave a review on Amazon, that would be fabulous. Amazon loves that kind of stuff. And
yes, they do.
A good review would be fantastic. And what else is going on? I did a music project. Thanks very much, Scott. Thank you very much, Tom. I did a music project called Highway Sentinels. David Reese is the vocalist. David used to be in a latter-day version of Accept. And mm-hmm. I called on some guitar player buddies of mine to do solos on these songs that I wrote with my friend Jimmy Waldo. Jimmy was the keyboard player and founder of Alcatraz. And we'd written songs sort of way back in the day. We sort of updated them, and I brought in some guitar players to kind of put some solos on there. So Joe Satriani plays a solo, Bumblefoot, Tracy Guns, Paul Gilbert, Matt Heathy, Joe Stump, Larry Flintz from a band called Riot, an amazing guitar player. And I play a guitar solo on one song. It's like, there's no way I'm not playing a solo on my song on an album with these guys. And so, you know, I played this solo. It was a good solo. It was more like a David Gilmour, you know, like a couple held notes, you know, like I'm going to try and, you know, battle these monsters, you know. But I sent each of them letters, you know, saying, guys, look, I, you know, Joe, Paul, you know, Tracy, look, man, I also did a solo, but don't worry, guys, you know, don't be too jealous. I try not to bring my A game, so I won't blow you away too bad. You know, they thought that was humorous. Very anyway, the Highway Sentinels thing, you know, if you guys want to check it out, it's up on YouTube. You can listen to the songs. I sell collectible guitar picks on eBay. If anybody needs, you know, Metallica picks or Linkin Park or You know, Motley Crue picks. I sell those on eBay. And yeah, man, it's all good. The second edition of the book has been going fantastically, and I'm just so happy, man. And really, man, you know, the response from everybody has just been more than I could have asked for. And I'm thankful that everybody has read it and really gotten so much out of it. You know, that's all I could have asked for. So.
Well, the effort shows, like I said. Yeah, no, thank you so much. And I honestly can't wait to dive back into it, you know, because it's just there's so many cool little excerpts. And if you're a music nerd like we are, then you're all going to love it. So please pick up Tone Chaser. If you get it on Amazon, leave a review. I'm going to go do that here in just a few minutes. So there it is. Steve Rosen, everybody. Thank you so much. Corey. Let the people know. Actually, before you do that, I'm going to do a rundown of our patrons. You guys, we have a Patreon. You know that. I talk about it all the time because I want you guys to join us, because look at all the fun stuff you can do. You can lurk as we record, throw in questions on the fly in real time. You can be involved, like see us, see behind the curtain before it's all edited and stuff. You can just join in on the conversation, join us for our live shows. And hey, if there's a tier that we don't have and you would really like us to have some sort of tier about something, we can make it happen. We'll find a way to make it happen. So absolutely, yes, within reason for sure, but absolutely we'll make it happen for you. So just to go on our list of patrons, to send a big old thank you to Matt Lacoste, Nate from the Deep Purple Podcast, Rava Flave, Josh Caldwell, Greg Zito, Michael Griffith, Chaz Charles, Sean McGinnity, Kevin Brown, Per Lineker, Scott Monroe, Ryan Powell, Jeff Brewer, Ben Andreozzi, Tom Armbruster, Scott Everett, Heath McCoy, Janice Risco, and Brad Gould. Thank you guys so much for helping us keep the lights on, keep the show going, and thank you all for your patience. I know you all have missed the wheel, but it's coming back very, very soon. But before that, make sure to tune into this episode. Corey, where else can people find the things that going on with us and with other like-minded podcasts?
Well, you can find us at www.podcastwellrock.com. Catch up on old episodes. As Mark alluded to, we're going through the entire Van Halen catalog one song at a time. We got about 27 songs left on the wheel before we finish the Van Halen catalog. So you can check out all the old shows there. You can pick up some merch. Please check out our friends at the Deep Dive Podcast Network. www.deepdivepodcastnetwork.com. Get a lot of like-minded shows, including a Deep Purple show. The Deep Purple Podcast is part of that group. Scott Haskin does a great show, too, on Uriah Heep. A lot of great stuff out there. Our good friend Kevin Brown does a Queen show. I do an Aerosmith show on there as well, and I'm really tempted to start a ZZ Top show. And Steve, I know you're kind of a Billy Gibbons fan. Any chance we can convince you to write a Billy Gibbons biography in the near future?
I don't know about a Billy Gibbons biography, but I could certainly regale you with some Billy Gibbons stories.
Ooh, save those stories and look, we joke all the time, but it's only kind of a joke. Corey is just going to take over. He has like five podcasts right now, and he's just taking over all of the podcasting airwaves one at a time until it's all just his own universe. So that ZZ Top show will happen. So you should expect an email from Corey. We're like, all right, come on the show and talk about the ZZ Top stories. So I'm just saying, don't be shocked.
Anytime, man.
Perfect. Tom, I'm going to give him the last question here. He asks, hey, Steve, when was the last time you listened to that jam you did with Edward on bass?
You know, Tom, I actually listened to that a couple days ago. It was pretty unbelievable. I wish I had been more adventurous, you know, but I think you can understand the situation. You know, you're sitting there, Edward's playing bass, you're playing one of his strats. You know, it's everything I can do to remember how to hold the fucking pick in my hand, you know, you know, and I played this riff that I had been messing with. You know, I was a songwriter, and, you know, I he's sitting there, you know, I'm thinking, come on, Rosen, play something, you know, and I start playing this riff, and instantly Edward jumps on it, you know, and he gets it. And within a few minutes, you can hear, I could sense Edward's approach, how he, how, you know, a sliver how he approaches his songs, you know, and how he would, you know, first he would kind of follow the changes I was doing. They were very simple changes, but it was a cool little riff. And then he'd kind of go outside, you know, and then he'd look for like B sections, and I could see, you know, that Van Halen brain working, you know, a little bit, and that was unbelievable. But I did listen to that the other day, and yeah, that was the other time, you know, we got done, and Edward, you know, reaches into the cassette player that's running and, you know, flips the little lid and hands me the tape, again, because he knew what it would mean to me. And on the other side of that, Edward recorded every single thing he ever did. There was always a cassette player going. I would be up at the house, in the house, not 5150, in the house, and literally there were cardboard boxes. I'm telling you, there must have been certainly hundreds and maybe thousands of cassettes of him just noodling. And then later on, you know, he gets 5150, and then there's all the multi-track recordings he has, you know, and they're in the Van Halen vault, which I was never in. I never saw that. But there are, you know, how many untold hours of stuff in there. Yeah, that was pretty amazing hearing that again. You know, wish I'd been a better guitar player. I mean, that's all I can say. It was pretty amazing. And just, you know, being there with him and again, him being so encouraging and, you know, him kind of, you know, he'd look up and give me the smile and be like, oh my God, you know,
what more could you possibly ask for, you know?
No more, nothing more. That was it. Yeah.
We all should strive.
Yeah. I think if I'd been like an amazing guitar player, then maybe it would, you know, the dynamic would have been different. Look, I mean, probably not. But, you know, I mean, if I sat with George Lynch, I mean, it would have been different, you know? I don't know. I mean, I wish I could play like George Lynch, of course, but, you know, it was amazing. It was amazing, Tom, and in response to your question, it was amazing hearing it again, for sure.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
All right. So with that being said, yeah, tune into the Deep Dive Podcasting Network. We got all sorts of rock and roll based shows. And if you don't hear a band that you love, I guarantee you a show is on the way. Corey will make it happen. It's all going to be part of the Corey Morissette podcasting universe before we're all done. He needs something else to do once the Van Halen show reaches its climax. So it's basically the ball is in his court. But check out all the other amazing shows we have. All of our great friends at Deep Dive Podcasting Network, www.podcastwillrock.com to catch up on old episodes of us. Check out our merch store. Buy yourself a T-shirt. Thank you, Kevin Brown, for all of your designs. And on behalf of Steve Rosen, go get Tone Chaser. On behalf of Corey Morissette, I am Mark Kammeyer, and we are, and the podcast will rock, and we will rock you later.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.